Hello and welcome to another episode of the NBCSports.com College Basketball Talk Podcast. It is Thursday, October 10th. My name is Rob Doster. I have a good episode on the way for you today. I was able to catch up with my colleague at NBC Sports, the one and only Travis Hines, and we are going to walk through everything American Athletic Conference. We're actually going to go through team by team in alphabetical order and break down each and every one of them. Yes, even East Carolina and even Tulane. This is the only podcast where you are going to get previews for East Carolina and Tulane. We are that thorough, and I guess you could probably say we are that dumb as well. Before we get into it, two things. One, you know what I got to ask, please rate, please review, and please subscribe to this podcast. Whether it's giving us 5 stars if you loved it, 4 stars if you just thought it was okay, or even just saying something nice or mean about me in the reviews, any interaction really does help. And I am still looking to get reviews that mention people's favorite random college basketball players. We got one the other day that actually mentioned Bryce Cotton from Providence, who was a guy as a UConn fan growing up, somebody that I was not too much a fan of, but I really did love his game, and I love that he was able to get a chance in the NBA. I thought that he was good enough to deserve it. He actually does have a lot in common with one of my favorite random college basketball players, which is Russ Smith, Mr. Russ Diculous himself. I don't think that there was anybody that fit the mold of a college legend better than Russ Smith during his time at Louisville. There's never been anyone that had less of a conscience when he shot the ball or when he had the ball in his hands, or when he decided he wanted to make a play. And I don't know if there will ever be a better nickname in college basketball history than Russ Diculous. He was a legend, and not just a legend in his own mind, a legend in my mind as well. And the last thing that we have to get into, it's going to get beat to death, I understand, but more stuff has happened with this Kansas, Snoop Dogg, Adidas, whatever controversy. Bill Self came out and made a statement on Wednesday night that more or less feels kind of like a direct attack at me. I'm going to read portions of the statement. They were tweeted out by the homie Jesse Newell over at the Kansas City Star. This is a quote from Self. "Anybody that knows me knows that I'm not smart enough to figure out some of those things that have transpired that would relate to anything other than that moment. If you followed us, I do stuff for late night every year. This year was no different. I just happened to be wearing an Adidas shirt who happens to be a sponsor for our next 14 years that helps sponsor the event. It was innocently given to me, and I just put it on. And I've already addressed and spoke to what happened the other night with Snoop Dogg. I don't know how an entertainer would in any way, shape, or form be thought to be sticking it to anybody, including the NCAA, by having an entertainer perform. I do not love the narrative that has been said concerning that with me, but I also understand that I can't control what the media writes or their opinions, and I do know that people that know me know that that's not factually true in any way, shape, or form," end quote. I don't know that I entirely believe Bill Self when he says that the thought of trolling the NCAA did not cross his mind when he decided to wear a t-shirt with the biggest Adidas logo that I've ever seen without any Kansas logo on it. I think that it is probably true that he did not realize that Snoop Dogg was going to come out and perform with stripper poles and with pole dancers and with money guns and all that. I believe that. I believe him when he says that. But even if he is telling the truth, Kansas is still at fault for not realizing what they are doing. Every single person that saw the hype video that showed Bill Self walking into a record store with an oversized Adidas logo on a white t-shirt that had no Kansas logos, no Kansas imagery on it anywhere, thought the exact same thing. How did nobody in that athletic department, how did Bill Self himself, how did no one look at that and say, I think that everybody on the internet is going to take this some type of way when they see this video? Bill Self is telling us that he did not intentionally troll the NCAA, then I guess we can take him at his word. But I think it is still very fair to say that it is incredibly dumb not to realize how wearing a t-shirt with that oversized Adidas logo, as the NCAA is handing down a notice of allegations with a litany of level one violations directed at your program because of their affiliation with Adidas, if you don't realize how that is going to get taken by people on the internet, then you need more internet savvy people working on your social media teams. I'll admit that there is room for Bill Self to be telling us the truth here. If Kansas fans and if Bill Self can admit that it was incredibly dumb of them not to realize how that was going to get taken. Now let's get into that conversation and that AAC preview with the one and only Travis Hines. And now making his triumphant return back to the College Basketball Talk podcast. For the first time in about 3 months, I'd like to welcome back on my colleague at CBT, the one and only Travis Hines. Travis, what is going on, man? How are you doing?
I'm good. 3 months? That's a long time not to be on the CBD podcast. I'm surprised there's any listeners left, frankly.
Yeah, no. I mean, how much did you miss me?
Quite a bit, actually, if we're going to be honest. Miss you a lot.
Yeah, I know. I'm kind of that magnetic personality, I guess you could say.
That's exactly what I would say.
All right. So you've spent some time, as have I, going through the American and looking at it. And for people that are unaware, what we're going to do here just kind of roll through every team in the American in alphabetical order and talk through what they lost and what they got coming in and what expectations are for the season. And at the end, we're going to make a bold prediction for each one of these teams. But before we kind of get into all of that, Travis, do you have any kind of overall big picture takes on the American and what you think it's going to be this year?
Yeah, I mean, I think overall it's going to be an interesting team with South Florida maybe coming up to that UCF spot that, you know, I think they'll probably be vacating. I think Temple with Aaron McKee is interesting. Obviously, UConn leaving the league after this year. What's Houston going to be after their Sweet 16 run? But obviously, the headliner here is Memphis. And I am so fascinated / excited about what Penny Hardaway's got going on in Memphis. You know, the more I think about it, the more I think the parallels with Duke last year work. Not only, I mean, obviously, Zion was a singular player probably in the last 10 years of college basketball, but James Wiseman, a potential top pick in next June's draft. But to me, the most obvious or the most interesting parallel to that year, to that team last year, is that I think Memphis is going to be must-watch basketball. I don't know if they're going to be nearly as good as Duke was last year, but I know that I desperately want to watch them every time they hit the floor because I find them so fascinating. You know, from Penny Hardaway on down, I think this team is going to be so fun to watch. They're going to talk endless smack. I mean, Penny Hardaway was already telling Rick Barnes to F off last year. I'm really excited for the spectacle that I think Memphis basketball can be, you know, not only with the talent that they have, with how good that they can be, but just I think they've got a level of swagger and trash talking vibe that I'm like a moth to the flame there. You can tell I'm excited to see what Memphis is going to do this year, not just on the court, but off the court.
Yeah. You know, I think that when we talk about personalities running basketball programs in the same way that Coach Cal is the perfect fit at Kentucky and like Mark Few is the perfect fit at Gonzaga, I can't imagine just a better fit for that Memphis program than Penny Hardaway, which kind of makes sense being as, you know, he's an alum and somebody that grew up in the city of Memphis. Overall, I kind of think that the American this year is going to be, it's not going to be quite as top heavy in my mind as people think. And I have certain takes on this Memphis program that we'll get to when we get to that that team preview. But I also think that like it's deeper and a little bit more competitive than maybe people think based on the amount of turnover that we have in the conference. You know, Houston lost a lot. Cincinnati lost their head coach and had four guys transfer out. Obviously, UConn is kind of like in their last year there, and they're still not back to what everyone thought they were going to be. But I do think this is the kind of year where we can get maybe five, possibly six, if things break the right way, teams coming out of this conference into the NCAA tournament. So we can kind of get into that, I guess. You think I'm reaching there with five or six teams?
Yeah, I mean, I could see four or five, six seems like a lot to me. And I guess we'll get through it, you know, as we go. But, I mean, it'll depend on, you know, if it's not top heavy, does that mean that teams are beating up on each other? Or does it mean that there's not enough quality wins? I think that'll be a big determining factor. And some of that is going to rest on what the rest of the country looks like. But to me, it'll be what do they do in the non-conference is going to be a huge indicator, or a huge determinant, I should say, of how many they can get in, because the league obviously does not get a high level of respect, you know, probably that it deserves after what we've seen from some of the teams in that league. But yeah, six seems like a lot to me.
Yeah, the big key, I think, is going to be what happens at the bottom of the conference. Like, Tulane and East Carolina and SMU have to be more than, like, total zeros this year. You know, I think we see it every year.
Hard to ask.
Yeah, I know, it might be. But, like, I mean, you cover Iowa State, you cover the Big 12, Travis, and you kind of see it there how the computer numbers for that conference are always so good, because there is no, like, there's no terrible teams. There's nobody that's completely overmatched year over year that ends up being in, like, the 150s or the 200s of these computer rankings, dragging everything down. I think last year, wasn't everybody in the top 80 in the Big 12? Like, Oklahoma State was one of the lower rated teams. And I think that they were, like, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but they were, like, right around the top 75, top 80 all year long.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge reason why that league gets so many teams into the NCAA tournament. I mean, it wasn't, I think, what, three seasons ago, they had a legit shot to get nine in. And that was your Iowa State was the worst team in the league. They were undoubtedly the worst team in the league, but they were far from a disaster. They had top 25 wins. And that's why you see that league year in and year out really, you know, be number one in the computer rankings and get, you know, more than half their membership into the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, and to put that conversation into a little bit of perspective, this past season, East Carolina ranked 264th in KenPom, and Tulane ranked 283rd. And these are the teams that actually ranked above both of those in KenPom's rankings. LIU Brooklyn, New Orleans, St. Francis, Fordham, UMass Lowell, the Citadel, Longwood, Cal State Northridge, Montana State. So there are some really bad teams that were better than both of those teams in all the computer numbers. So that's kind of what drags some of that stuff down. But you know, we should probably just get into talking about this this conference as a whole and breaking it down team by team. So I'm going to start things off with Cincinnati.
One thing to note before we dive into this, the podcast was recorded before we got word on Jerron Cumberland's foot and some of the injuries that other players on Cincinnati are currently dealing with. So just keep that in mind as we go through this conversation.
And Travis, I want to see if you can name this. There are six programs that have been to each of the last nine NCAA tournaments. Can you name all six?
Duke.
Mm-hmm.
Gonzaga.
That's two.
Michigan State.
That's three.
North Carolina.
That's four.
Purdue.
Not Purdue.
Wisconsin. You're missing, not Kansas.
Kansas is five. And do you know what number six is? It should be obvious. Who are we previewing right now?
Cincinnati.
What is that?
Seven?
Yeah, no, that's six. Those are the six teams that have been to the last nine NCAA tournaments. And those are the shoes that John Brannon is going to have to try to fill now that Mick Cronin is off to UCLA. So it's not going to be easy for him to live up to kind of what the expectations have been at Cincinnati over the course of the last decade. And I know it's neither here or there, but I don't think we should ever really overlook what Mick Cronin was able to do from building that program up. Like, when he first got the job, there was one player on the roster. They had to go and recruit players off of the football team to be able to, you know, fill out a roster in his first couple of seasons that he was in Cincinnati. So it's not like he walked in there and Cincinnati was what it was during the height of the Bob Huggins era. So Mick Cronin really built that thing up, and I think it deserves mention what he has built there. And I think it should make us appreciate what John Brannon is going to be asked to do, kind of fill in those shoes. And honestly, like, look, they lost a couple guys to graduation, and they lost four players to transfer, and they only have five guys coming back that, like, played legitimate minutes for them last season. But I still think that Cincinnati has a chance to be a tournament team this year. And it all kind of starts with Jerron Cumberland, who, like, he's just an absolute killer, man. For me, he's a third-team preseason All-American. I think I would probably say that it's either going to be him or James Wiseman, in my mind, for who ends up being the preseason player of the year in the American. And I love everything about this dude's game. Like, he's 6'5". He's built like a linebacker. He's a big-time scorer. He averaged 19 points, 5 boards, and 3.5 assists as a junior last season. I think that he's an absolute killer. I think he's a shot maker. I think he is the kind of guy that can lift everyone else around him. And he's going to need to do that because I don't know just how good his supporting cast or just how deep his supporting cast is going to end up being. They added this kid from Oakland, Javon Cumberland, who was actually Jaron's cousin, who averaged 17 points and 3.5 assists for Oakland last year. They added another grad transfer from Western Kentucky, Chris McNeil. They bring back Keith Williams. They bring back Trevor Moore. They bring back big guys, Trey Scott and Mamadou Diarra. But beyond that, like that is about – oh, no, they got a freshman coming in named Zach Harvey who should be able to give him some minutes as a shooter off the bench. But beyond that, like I don't know how much – deeper they're going to get. And I don't know how many of those guys are going to be able to step up and play maybe bigger roles. You know, I'm curious to see what Keith Williams can do when he's going to be asked to carry more of the load. I think that Trevor Moore is going to, like, he needs to step up and be better than he was the last 2 years. I think, you know, the same can be said with Trey Scott. You know, losing Nizer Brooks, who was a junior that ended up graduating and transferring. That one's going to actually he didn't graduate, but he just transferred, but that's going to hurt them. So I don't think it's necessarily going to be easy. And I don't know if Cincinnati is necessarily going to be a top 25 program this year. But I do think that Brandon is a very good coach. I'm going to be fascinated to see how they adjust to his style of play, which is not exactly the same kind of like physical defense and rebounding first and foremost style that Mick Cronin wanted to play. But with the both of the Cumberlands there, I think they're going to have a really good 1-2 punch. And as long as Cumberland, my bold prediction is basically that Cumberland ends up being the guy that leads the conference in scoring, has an All-American caliber season. And while Cincinnati, I don't think they'll ever crack the top 25. I do think they're going to end up being a tournament team and a dangerous team once they get to March, because you just never know when Cumberland's going to pop off for like a 30-point game. So that's kind of what my bold prediction is.
Yeah, I think you're right on there. I mean, Cumberland, to me, again, I agree with you that he's a preseason All-American, and I would give him the edge over Wiseman just because of his experience for the player of the year. And I think he's important to, you know, mention that they're not going to probably play the same style under Brandon that they did under Cronin. But I think having Cumberland back is a good bridge for the culture there, because – you know, that tough, hard-nosed style, I think, is going to continue, at least in terms of the culture under Brandon that they had under Mick Cronin, just because I think that's the type of player you can recruit to Cincinnati. And I think Cumberland is a good bridge to that, because he really embodies that to me, that tough, badass type guard that's had success there in Cincinnati.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point, that if you're going to have like one guy that's a holdover that is a star, it might as well be the star that is kind of in that senior mold, like Jaron Cumberland. But let's move on. Let's talk to me a little bit about UConn here, Travis.
Yeah, so they go 16-17 in Danny Hurley's first year in stores after coming over from Rhode Island. And I don't think it's any secret what tough spot the Huskies were in after Kevin Ollie's tenure there disintegrated after that national title. But the good news for Hurley is they got 4 of 5 guys that started last year back. Bad news is the one that's gone is Jalen Adams, who had averaged 17-4 last year. So that's a big loss that they're going to have to figure out. But you know, the two, to me, biggest returners is Christian Vital, who averaged 14-6-2 last year. More importantly, shot just under 41% from 3-point range. Is back. So is Al-Tariq Gilbert, you know, a guy that just whose career has just never quite locked into place because of injuries. He was a former McDonald's All-American, but has never really had a full healthy season. Still averaged 13-3 last year. They've also got Josh Carlton, who was the league who shared most improved honors in the league last year. Tyler Polly is back. And then an interesting guy that they had enroll mid-year last year is 6'9", Akok, who was a top 100 recruit, enrolled mid-year last year and redshirted, should be able to help out this season. And then obviously the subtext to their entire year will be this move from the Big East. I mean, they've probably underachieved, to put it mildly, in their time in the AAC, and it's been clear they've been eyeing an exit to me for at least a few years, and they're probably going to be a better fit in the Big East. But what does the rest of the league have it out for them? Because them leaving the AAC is really going to cause some waves there, and not for the positive, I think, for that league that it kind of started to position it well itself pretty well in basketball. So do they have a target on their back, despite probably not being one of the two or three best teams in the league? Is that going to make things a little bit more difficult for them? I think that's an interesting question, because every week they're going to get questions about this being their last time in Tulsa, their last time in New Orleans, and so on and so forth. But I think there's enough talent there, and I think the experience in this league is going to be important. So my bold prediction, and I'm going to throw Altari Gilbert a bone here. I'm going to predict that he's healthy this season, which makes him a first-team all-conference type player. First-team all-conference player. I'm not going to qualify that. And to me, if he's at that level, because I think Vital will be, you know, better than he was last year, to me, that puts UConn in the NCAA tournament in their second year under Hurley, and they're last in the AAC.
I kind of agree with all of that. The big thing, I think, is going to be how well – and it's actually, I believe it's pronounced a cook. Travis, I don't know if you're trying to get this podcast the explicit tag or what, but I'm pretty sure it's pronounced the cook a cook. The makeup of these teams, or this team that he has this year, is really similar to what like Danny Hurley's best teams were at Rhode Island, right? Like, he always thrived when he had really, really good guards. And I think if you look at Altariq Gilbert, you look at the two kids that got coming in, and Jalen Gaffney and James Boonight, and you look at Christian Vital, who I hope ends up being a guy that is more than just kind of like a shooter and a scorer, which is a little bit what he's been in the past, then you have some really good guards that can give you a little bit of versatility, especially if, like, Sid Wilson. I'm not convinced that he's ever going to end up being able to live up to kind of that, like, top 75 four-star prospect hype that he had coming out of high school. But if he can be a guy that can kind of – you can slide in as that perimeter-based four, like the big wing, then I think that this team gets really, really interesting. But I'm with you, man. I think that they are good enough to make it to a tournament. But overall, I do think that they are a year away. Although I do think that with what they've been able to recruit and what they've been bringing in and who they've been in the mix with, that Danny Hurley has this thing heading in the right direction. And I got to make a confession, man. As a guy that grew up a UConn fan, I am very, very excited to see them heading back to the Big East.
You are a Husky homer.
I am.
It's well known.
I am.
It's well known.
The two things that we got in Connecticut are the UConn Huskies and the best pizza on the planet. And I will.
God, I knew you were going to talk about the pizza.
I will ride or die for the Huskies and for my pizza until the day that I die. All right, let's keep it moving then. Before I get into too much stuff talking about the state of Connecticut, moving on to East Carolina. Now, if you thought that there was an East Carolina resurgence coming, with Joe Dooley in the fold, then this is literally what I have written in my notes. LOL. They won three AAC games last season. Two of the three were against Tulane, who won zero AAC games last season. And I'm not going to sit here and pretend that I watched a lot of East Carolina basketball last year, because I didn't. But I pulled up their KenPom page, and here are some of the things where they rank outside the top 330 on KenPom. Effective field goal percentage, defensive free throw rate, which means that they foul a lot. They ranked 349th out of 353 teams in three-point percentage. They ranked 350th out of 353 teams in their percentage of points scored from three. And they ranked 337th in the percentage of shots they took from beyond the arc. In other words, they really, really, really sucked. And they bring back two of their top three scorers, which is like a good thing. But based on what I can tell and just kind of lining up rosters with what their verbal commits page looks like at the moment, they lost eight players to transfer. Eight guys. And they basically went 10 deep. So they lost. They bring back two of their top three scorers. Then they other eight guys that they played either transferred or graduated. So that is a big number. They have 11 new bodies coming in. Seven guys are from the JUCO ranks. They have four freshmen. But, like, whatever, dude. My bold prediction is I don't give a single fuck about the Pirates.
That is bold. That is bold. And you accuse me of trying to get us an explicit tag here.
Listen, I'm done, man. I'm done. What do you want to talk about Houston?
Yeah, man. Let's talk about Houston. Obviously, coming off one of the best years since the Phi Slamma Jamma era. 33-4, lost just two AAC games, made the Sweet 16. Really just a fantastic season start to finish for Kelvin Sampson's Cougars. This year, though, might be a bit of a more uphill battle against the league, losing Corey Davis Jr., Armani Brooks, and Galen Robinson Jr. That's 38 points per game gone from last year's Sweet 16 team. They do have Dejan Giroux back, who averaged 9 points a game last year. He was the AAC Sixth Man of the Year. I think that there's a lot of expectation that he's going to be able, or that he's going to be called on to fill in as maybe the star of this Houston team. They also have Cedric Alley and Fabian White back, both of whom started games last year. But maybe the most important thing for Houston is that they've got Kelvin Sampson back after, you know, obviously being courted by or potentially courted by a number of larger programs. They signed him to a 6-year, $18 million deal that presumably is going to keep him in a resource-rich, suddenly, Houston program going forward. I think the rest of the roster coming back is not as exciting. They got Bryce and Gresham, Chris Harris coming back, two guys in the front court that averaged together 25 minutes a game. Justin Gorham sat out last year after transferring from Towson. He is 6'7", averaged 10 points a game last year. They think, or they hope, that he can help spread the floor. In the backcourt, I think that they're going to lean a little bit on redshirt freshman Caleb Mills, who they seem to be high on. There was talk, I think, early to mid-summer that maybe they would try to get Quentin Grimes, the Kansas transfer, an immediate eligibility waiver, but that never really materialized. It doesn't seem that they even ever really applied for it. So lots to fill for Kelvin Sampson in Houston. They still have talent across the roster that's probably going to keep them in the upper echelon of the AAC, but I don't know that it's going to be enough to get them into that top three or four, frankly. And so my bold prediction is, because of the talent loss, because of what we talked about earlier, Rob, that maybe the top of the league is not as strong, I think that's going to get them in that squishy 4 or 5 spot, and they're going to miss the NCAA tournament.
See, where I kind of stand on Houston is that I think Dejan Giroux is going to end up having a big, big year. I think that Nate Hinton is going to step up. I do like your take on Caleb Mills, and I have faith in their front court. It's just like a bunch of it's deep, and they got some guys that are pretty solid. Which is kind of like last year, what they did was they basically just rotated through 5 guys and kind of played them all more or less equal minutes. But mostly my take on Houston is that that they have Kelvin Sampson. I'm going to bet on Kelvin Sampson finding a way to make it work. And I think if I had to make a bold prediction, my bold prediction would be that Houston actually wins the league.
Well, see, I think where we differ is on Giroux. I think he'll be fine, but I'm skeptical that he's going to be a first-team all-league type player. And if you think he's going to be that, then I think – they make the NCAA tournament and probably contend for the, you know, maybe 1-2-3 spot. But to me, I think he'll be a nice player. I'm skeptical that he's going to be that elite American player that apparently you think. Because I think that is probably where things diverge into two paths. If you think he's going to be a star, then you think Houston's going to be really good. If you think he's just going to be good like I do, I think you just think Houston's going to be fine.
Yeah, I think he's going to have a really, really big season. I have him listed as a preseason first team. All American, I guess, but like all AAC. How do you say that? All AAC. I'm going all AAC. All American is a little bit confusing.
American first team, so something. Yeah, yeah. That's a good question. It's like they purposely did that to screw with us.
Yeah, I know. To mess with us, we're all here on this podcast. So, I'm in on the idea that Dejan Giroux is going to be really good. And like the other part of it is, I'm not in the business of betting against Kelvin Sampson. That seems like a losing proposition. So I just have a feeling he's going to find a way to figure this out. It just he does it every year, you know. Like I don't think that losing the pieces that he loses is necessarily going to be like the death blow for him. Because remember, like they lost Rob Gray after the 2018 season. We were all kind of like, well, what are they going to do now? They lost Rob Gray. They lost the best player on their team. How are they going to figure this out? Oh, Corey Davis ends up being like a borderline NBA guy. And Armani Brooks becomes good enough where he can declare for the draft and go sign a contract and play professionally. And, you know, I think that Dejan Giroux is going to be the next guy that kind of steps up. Now, I don't know how long you are able to continue it like that. And there's a separate conversation to have about whether or not, like, being able to pay players in their NIL rights would help with situations like that and keeping them, like, maybe an Armani Brooks in school for an extra year. But I do think that that Houston is going to end up being really, really good. I think they're going to be a tournament team, and I think there's a very real chance that they can end up winning the American Conference this year.
I mean, I would think, like, if paying for the name and likeness can sway guys like that, Houston is situated pretty well, because they basically have a patron in Houston Rockets owner. Is it Tim Ferita?
Yep.
Is that his name? The new gym's named after. Yeah. So, I mean, if that does come into play, I would think that that would work out pretty well for Houston.
You know who else?
Given that that dude's clearly sinking tons of money into the program.
Yeah. You know who else paying NIL rights would really help out with? Memphis. That's who we're going to talk about next. I want you to picture this. So Penny Hardaway is worth like $100 million. That's about what he made. That's what he made playing in his NBA career. Memphis is closely affiliated with FedEx, right? And with Mike Miller, who made a whole bunch of money in his NBA career, and from what I understand has done pretty well investing it. You have all of that money floating around, and money can be paid to players with their NIL rights. And suddenly, not only you add that to the fact that Penny and Mike Miller are already two of the best recruiters in the college basketball realm right now. Just imagine what Memphis would be able to get if this stuff opens up.
Could it get better than what they had this year? I feel like I can exactly imagine what they could get.
Yeah. So what you're referring to, for people that don't know, is that Memphis actually has the number one recruiting class in the country. Better, it's rated better than Duke. It's rated better than Kentucky. It's rated better than Kansas. It's number one. The biggest reason for that is that they have the number one prospect in the country in James Wiseman, a guy that many people think is going to end up being the number one overall pick in the 2020 draft. They also bring in another five-star, Precious Achiuwa, who is a top 10 prospect, I guess. And the rest of the class, and this is kind of where – Memphis has kind of been one of the teams that has gotten the most hype during the offseason. I've seen a lot of people rank them in the preseason top 10. I think Gary Parrish at CBS Sports had them in the top five at one point. I don't know if they're still there, but they were definitely in the top five at one point. I kind of get it, right? But this is kind of where I differ from where everyone else is all in on Memphis. And that's because the reason that they are the number one class is the depth of the class. It's not because of the star power. Like in past years, take last season, for example, right? Duke was the number one overall recruiting class. They had R.J. Barrett, Cam Reddish, and Zion Williamson. And if you can believe it, Zion was actually the lowest rated of those three recruits. The year before that, it was Duke when they had Marvin Bagley, Wendell Carter, and Gary Trent was the fourth highest rated recruit in that class. And what we've seen is a lot of these elite prospects going to these programs where they cluster, right? Trevon Duval was in that class with Duke as well. So they had four top 15 guys. And that's not what we're seeing at Memphis. They have two top 10 guys, and the other five guys in this recruiting class are kind of in that 30 to 100 range, where you're getting four-star prospects that are more than likely going to end up spending 2, 3, maybe 4 years in college. And that's really, really good for the Memphis program as a whole. If you're going to get 2 or 3 years out of Lester Quinones, I think by the time he leaves, you're going to have an all AAC player on your hands, right? If you're going to get 2 years out of DJ Jeffries, I think he's going to be really, really good in that second season. But I'm not convinced that these guys are going to be able to step in and have as big of an impact as freshmen as I think a lot of people are thinking that they will. You know, the biggest concern to me is that it looks like Penny's going to end up starting five freshmen. And how often do we see teams that start five freshmen end up being, that good? We always talk about how, you have to be concerned when Kentucky doesn't have that experienced presence, or you have to be concerned because Duke doesn't have that experienced presence, or we have to go celebrate Duke because they happen to have Quinn Cook starting alongside Tyus Jones, who was a top five prospect, and Jahlil Okafor, a top five prospect, and Justice Winslow, who was a top 10 prospect in that class. So I'm worried about the lack of a veteran presence. There are three guys that return, and they did play a lot of minutes. But the other problem, like, this is the other thing, like, Memphis fans have been coming at me about this idea that, like, we bring back more than Duke brings back, and we bring back more than Kentucky brings back. And, well, yes, you do. You bring back a lot of those minutes. These guys are not necessarily good enough to be playing at the level that you want them to be playing at now, right? Two of the three guys that are returning are 5'9" point guards on a team that has two freshmen coming in that look like they're going to end up fighting for that starting point guard role, and Damian Bowe and Boogie Ellis. So every time that Tyler Harris and Alex Lomax are on the floor, you're taking off two guys that you thought were going to end up being starters. And I don't know how often you can actually play Tyler Harris and Alex Lomax together. The other problem, the other guy they're bringing back is Isaiah Maurice, who is a senior center that plays basically the same position as James Wiseman. Every time he's on the floor, it means that you have to take off maybe one of the top five players in the country. So come on, put all of that together, the youth that's on the roster, the fact that I'm not necessarily a believer in the guys that they have coming back being good enough to compete at the level that Memphis thinks that Memphis wants to be able to compete at. Combine that with the fact that the reason they have the number one recruiting class is because there was a lack of clustering anywhere in the class of 2019. And I can just see, like, I don't want to say the wheels fall off, because I still think that they're going to be a top 25 team all season long. And I still think that there's a good chance they could end up winning the American Athletic Conference regular season title. I still think that if everything comes together, there's enough talent on that roster that I would not be shocked if they won a final, if they made it to the Final Four. Like, look, I have a ticket at 50-1 odds for a future for Memphis winning the national title. Like, I bet my own money. I invested my own money on Memphis going out to win the title because I realize that's what their ceiling is. But I think that their floor is much, much lower than anyone's really given them credit for. At this point, and I can see more paths to them being a team that kind of ends up in the back end of the top 25 or out of the top 25 than I see them ending up being a team that is like top five and hitting their ceiling. So my bold prediction is that come Selection Sunday, Memphis is not getting a top five seed.
Yeah, I think that they're kind of a classic high wire act type team, like you mentioned. I mean, if they can stay on that line, like, they're going to be really, really good. If they're not able to walk that line, like, they could fall pretty far. You know, the guy that you didn't mention as part of that recruiting class that didn't show up was Rajon Tucker, the Little Rock transfer that committed to Memphis and then ultimately decided to stay in the NBA draft, didn't get drafted. I think he signed an Exhibit 10 with the Bucks. But, like, if he sticks with Memphis with that commitment is on the roster, I mean, then are they that top five team for you right now?
I don't know. I probably wouldn't have them top five, but I definitely would have them ranked higher. Like, I think that he's the kind of guy that could be the difference between them being like a top 25-ish team and being a top 15-ish team. And that's because, one, you're adding a guy that has been proven that he can score at the college level. Even if it's at Arkansas Little Rock, he averaged 20 points a game there, right? Yeah. He's a terrific athlete. He's a really, really good shooter. That's another thing. Like, I don't necessarily know where all the shooting is going to come from on this roster. So I just think adding, and plus, like, he's 22 years old. Like, he's a man, right? He's a senior. He would be a redshirt senior. So I do think that having him on the roster would have made a difference. But I don't know if he's also like, look, it's Rajon Tucker. We're not talking about adding, you know, like Cassius Winston, right? It's Rajon Tucker. So I do think that he would have helped, and he would have helped provide a little bit of veteran presence. But I'm not like, he's not the guy that's going to turn them from being like really good to a team that is a lock to be great.
Yeah, I think I don't have a 50-1 ticket on him, but I do really want Memphis to be good, just for all the reasons I said at the top. I think college basketball is going to be 10 times more interesting if Memphis is really good. I still think they're going to be nationally relevant, whether or not they're great this year, just because of Penny and because of the potential lottery picks on that team. But to me, this college basketball season is going to be at reach its interest potential if Memphis is awesome. So I guess I'm emotionally invested in Memphis being good, whereas you're financially invested.
Yeah, and here's the other thing about it is, like, so you mentioned how you're here for the spectacle. Like, one of the things that I really, 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 really like about this group is that, like, they're just they're overflowing with confidence. Almost to the, like, I don't want to say it's too much, because I don't think you can ever necessarily have too much confidence if you can back it up. But like, Penny came out and said to Daniel O'Neal of The Athletic, like, we're going to win the national title. Did you see that quote?
I did. I love Penny. Like, that dude just, for obvious reasons why, has no fear about just talking his team up to just obviously high degrees.
Yeah. Love it. And it's not just him either. Like, I don't know if you saw Lester Quinones on Twitter, but like, one of the things that he said, so he's been going at like Tennessee, former Tennessee players, when they have something to say. Like, Admiral Schofield tweeted, "We really spanked them," about Memphis at some point this offseason. And Lester Quinones quote tweeted that with, "Come to Knoxville for the game this year if the Go-Go's don't have a game that night." Because Admiral Schofield is playing in the G League, which is, oh man, that's just great. I love it. And like, he's had more of those. Like, I can't find the other ones right now, but I love the clapbacks. I love the swagger that they have and the way that they play. So, yes, I'm with you. I want them to be good. I just see more paths to them not living up to the exceedingly high expectations that they have. And here's another part of it that maybe we're diving too deep on this one, but here's the other thing that concerns me with this, right? Let's say that Penny Hardaway, with a roster full of freshmen, only two of whom are like five-star prospects, ends up being a team that is, and I'm air quoting here, is only like 23-10 on Selection Sunday and ends up as a sixth seed. Like, to me, based on what he has on that roster, the fact that it's only his second year as a head coach in the college ranks, based on how young his roster is, that's a successful season. That's a good season. But if he does that, it's going to end up looking like a massive failure, because there was top five hype for them, and he had the number one prospect in the country, and they were only a sixth seed in the tournament that went to the second weekend. So, like, part of what's happening here is the hype is kind of setting them up for failure, even if they have what would be a very good season based on what they have on the roster. So that's another thing that concerns me. Like, what happens if they only end up like being at like their 60th percent outcome or 60th percentile outcome and going 25-10 and reaching the second round of the tournament? What happens then?
Well, like, so I'll throw that back at you. What happens? Like, I don't think it's going to like be for the reasons you laid out about how they really probably only have two stone cold one and dones. They get a ton of talent coming back. And do you think Penny Hardaway is going to back down at all from his posturing? And like, the other deal too, like, whatever hype they have, they're clearly putting it up themselves. Like, you saw the tweets from Memphis Madness the other night with all the smoke stuff that they won. Like, usually you can blame us in the media for overhyping a young team's interesting and sexy, but like, Memphis is leaning into this with like unparalleled exuberance, which I applaud them for, but I don't think that when they start, if they struggle mid-year and start saying, well, we're young, I'm not really going to buy that as an excuse, because they don't care about it now.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's my point. It's not just, it's not Penny. It's more, you know, what? How does that weigh on the players? And, you know, how does that weigh on future recruiting kind of stuff? So, I don't know. I just think it's an interesting angle that doesn't always get talked about when we talk about preseason hype. But we've spent enough time on Memphis now. Let's keep it moving. Talk to me a little bit about the SMU Mustangs, Travis.
15-17 last year. Tim Jankovic's team loses Jamal McMurray, who averaged 18 points a game last year. Jimmy Witt went for 12-4. Both of those guys are gone off a team that struggled. And it's really been since Tim Jankovic took over this team in 2016, kind of last minute when Larry Brown just peaced out in the summer. They went 30-5 last year. 17 wins the following year, 15 last year. So this thing is pointed in the wrong direction. But the good news for Jankovic is that this is the first time he's going to have a full roster there in Dallas, because the NCAA scholarship reduction penalties for what I believe was academic issues it has been lifted. So they've got the full complement of 13 scholarships. And also back is 6'9" forward Ethan Chargois, I think, who averaged 12-6, you know, could be one of the better players in the league this season. Isaiah Mike is back too, another forward, 6'8", averaged 12-5. The big question mark for SMU, I think, is twofold. You know, what is Jankovic's coaching security there. And on the floor, the biggest question marks are the waiver situations for TCU transfer Kendrick Davis and Cal transfer Darius McNeil. Both of those guys have applied for immediate eligibility. As of, I believe, even a week ago, Jankovic was talking about how they had not heard anything yet from the NCAA and that they were worried it might bleed into the season. Without those two guys, I think they could be at the bottom of the league again this season. My bold prediction is if both of those guys get their eligibility waivers approved by the NCAA and are able to play all season long, I'm going to say SMU has a chance to finish in the top half of the league. I don't think they're an NCAA tournament team by any stretch, but if those two are able to play, you know, I think they're going to be, you know, right at number six.
Yeah, that's a big if, and I really don't have anything else to add about SMU. I just, they're kind of, they went from being like this exciting program in the like the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex to being the team we all forgot about because now TCU is that exciting program in the Dallas Metroplex.
Yeah, and Houston is interesting, and Houston as a city school that, you know, has had historic success but not recent success. So I think, yeah, the shine has definitely worn off there at SMU.
Yeah, how about that? The teams that are interesting and fun and exciting in the state of Texas are, in order, Texas Tech, Houston, TCU, and Baylor. And maybe that order is not exactly correct, but those are the four teams that are exciting. And it's not SMU, who had Larry Brown and Emmanuel Mudiay committed and won 30 games just a couple years ago, or those Texas Longhorns. So I think there's a conversation that can be had about that on a different podcast, not on this one, because we need to talk about South Florida. And I think you alluded to them earlier, Travis, but I think South Florida is going to be better than anybody realizes. You know, they're kind of like the laughingstock of college sports because they're USF, but they won 24 games last season, right? They won the CBI. They beat UConn. They beat Memphis. They beat Wichita State. They were really good defensively. I believe they were like a top 40 team in defensive efficiency, according to KenPom. They bring basically everyone back too, and like that's the big thing. Nine guys last year averaged at least 14 minutes and played at least 35 of their 38 games, and eight of those nine guys are back. They include starting guards David Collins and LaQuincy Radu. It includes Justin Brown on the wing. It includes big men that started last year, Michael Durr and Alex Yetna, both of whom were freshmen last season. Xavier Castaneda is back. Anton Maricevich is back. Mayan Kerr is back. And I know I'm just kind of like rattling off names, but there are three names that you really, really need to know that UCF is bringing back that are actually going to matter in the grand scheme of the American race. And that's David Collins, LaQuincy Radu, and Alexis Yetna. Collins and Radu are going to – I think that you can make an argument that they'll end up being like the best backcourt in the conference. That might be a little bit hot takey. But I do think that how good they are defensively, how disruptive they are, and especially if like they can kind of tone down the turnovers a little bit and get a little bit more efficient and more more protective of the ball, then I think that we're looking at like really the best backcourt in the AAC. Then throw in Yetna, who averaged 12 points, 10 boards, and shot 37% from three as a 6'8" freshman four-man. And like that is a really, really good core to build around, especially when you are as good defensively as they are, and especially when you factor in that they basically bring everybody back. I think there is a lot to like about this UCF team, or I'm sorry, this USF team. And I think that my bold prediction is that they end up finishing top four in the league, and they are one of those teams. When I'm talking about like the potential to get six teams in the tournament, they are one of those six. I think they make the NCAA tournament this year.
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. Just their experience coming back is going to be huge. And that'll be, I don't think that they're obviously not an overwhelmingly talented team, but they've got enough talent with that. When you couple it with that experience, that I think that an NCAA tournament is absolutely on the table for them.
Yeah, they are. They're interesting, man. I'll leave it at that. You got anything else to add about UCF? I'm sorry, USF. I'm going to keep doing that.
I got nothing else on the Bulls.
All right, so let's keep it moving. Talk to me about those Temple Owls.
They went 23-10 in Fran Dumfries' swan song, got to the NCAA tournament, And now Dunphy and the Eagles are turning it over to alum and Philadelphia, dare I say, legend, Aaron McKee. Is that fair, given his time with the 76ers?
I'll give it to him. Give it to him.
Taking over after a stint on Dunphy's bench and the 76ers bench as well. He will not have the services of 20-point scorer Shiz Alston, excuse me, from last year, who has graduated. But the Owls do have some interesting pieces back. Quentin Rose averaged 16 points a game last year. Nate Pierre-Louis was the conference's co-most improved player of the year, and I think maybe one of the more interesting additions that they've got is Monty Scott, Kennesaw State transfer, who averaged 17 points a game last year. I kind of like this Temple team. You know, they've got enough pieces. I think Rose is really, really good. To me, he's a first-team all-conference player. I like Pierre-Louis. Scott, I think, can help them score the basketball. I think they've got enough back that they're looking – I kind of feel like them on the same plane as South Florida, where I've got them in the top four, which to me puts them on the NCAA tournament bubble. For you, that would put them in the NCAA tournament. But I'm gonna say a fourth-place finish gets them right on the precipice on Selection Sunday in McKee's first season.
Yeah, I mean, they're right there. And, you know, I was – and talking with people that are kind of like working that league and coaching that league, the thing that everyone talks about is just how much they're bringing back, right? Like UCF brings back basically everyone. And I think if you look at in total what
USF brings
back, like I did it again. USF brings back basically everyone, and Temple brings back the second most in the league. And not only are they bringing back the second most, but like Nate Pierre-Louis is really, really good. And Quentin Rose is really, really good. And there are a lot of experienced bodies on that roster. The big question is going to be, like, how good is Aaron McKee as a coach? And I don't think that we necessarily know, but I do think that he is he's got plenty of pieces at his disposal this year, so we're going to find out pretty quickly whether or not he's up to the task.
Yeah, and he's got the resume too. You know, this is not a, you know, like a Penny Hardaway last year that came in with no experience. Like, McKee has been on some pretty solid staffs and been part of good teams where that I feel pretty confident. Like, maybe he turns out not to be a great head coach, but I would be shocked if he's not a competent one given his resume and experience that I think with this group that they have is going to be more than enough to put them, you know, right in the conversation or the NCAA tournament.
Yeah. I'm not super worried about him being a total, like, I don't think he's going to be Chris Mullin. I don't know if he's going to end up being like Fred Hoiberg, like that level, but I do think that he's going to end up being like, he'll be fine. I'm not really worried about all that. So let's keep it moving. I need to tell you guys about Tulane, and I kind of referenced it earlier, but Tulane went 0-18 in the American last season. They went 4-27 overall, and they lost every game that they played after December 17th. They have a new hire. They got rid of Mike Dunleavy, and they're bringing in Ron Hunter from Georgia State, who at the very least is going to bring some like life and excitement to that program. I don't know if there's a more energetic or gregarious coach in college basketball than Ron Hunter. And this is a little bit of a tangent, but still, for me, like, top five moment in NCAA history is when he has the torn Achilles tendon that he suffered while celebrating Georgia State winning the Sun Belt tournament title. Tore his Achilles celebrating that, goes to the NCAA tournament, has to sit on a stool. His son, RJ Hunter, hits a 30-foot three with 2 seconds left in the game to beat number 3 seed Baylor. And as he's celebrating, he just throws his hands up in the air. The stool wipes out from underneath him. He lands flat on his back, and he's just on the ground. Like, you see him kicking his legs like a beetle. It's stuck on his back, celebrating the fact that his son just buried a 28-footer. Was it Baylor or Iowa State they beat?
It was Baylor.
It was Baylor, yeah. So to beat, like, Rico Gathers and Baylor, great moment, unbelievable moment. I'm excited to have him. You know, you put that personality – with the school that's in New Orleans. And I think that there's the potential for some great things happening there. But as far as like the actual school and program itself, like, look, I think that he's got a chance to really get that thing rolling. People may not realize this, but in 2017, 2018, Tulane had two players on their roster that ended up playing in the NBA last year in Cam Reynolds and Melvin Frazier, who was like the number 32 pick in the draft or something like that. So you can get talent there. Right, their point guard last season is Caleb Daniels, who ended up transferring to Villanova. He's going to sit out a year, and he's probably going to be the guy that takes over for Colin Gillespie when he graduates from Villanova. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to happen this season. He does have some talent in there. He did get some nice transfers. He's got 9 newcomers, including KJ Lawson, who's the kid from Kansas. They got a kid transferring in from Arkansas. They got a kid transferring in from Georgia. They got one coming in from Rhode Island. So, like, there's a couple of interesting pieces there, and there's probably a little bit more talent on the roster than they had last season. But I do think that it's going to take him a while to kind of get that thing going. But I'm bullish on the program as a whole. I'm not as bullish on them this year, but my bold prediction is they don't actually finish in last place this year. I think they get out of the cellar and they finish in the top 11 of the American Conference this season, which, considering they went 0-18 last year, like, that's a big leap, man. I'm going out on a limb with this one.
No, I agree. And I mean, you already mentioned about what you thought about Eastern Carolina, or East Carolina. So maybe this isn't as bold a take as you thought it was, but.
Exactly. Talk to me about Tulsa.
What's that?
I said, talk to me about Tulsa. I don't care what you have to say about Tulsa. We can move on.
All right, great.
Keep it moving.
Tulsa, 18-14 last year. Daquan Jeffries is gone. Sterling Taplin's gone. Karan Scott is gone. Off a team that struggled last year in the AAC. Martins Igbanu is back, 6'8 senior, average 12-6. Jariah Horn, the one-time Nebraska Cornhusker, is back, who averaged 10-5 a year ago. They're going to lean probably pretty heavily on a pair of junior college transfers, one being a 7-footer named Emmanuel Ugbo. The other is Brandon Rochelle, a 6'6 junior college transfer. And another transfer, Western Michigan's Reggie Jones, who averaged 10 points a game for the Mustangs. To me, Tulsa isn't very interesting overall in the Frank Haith era. They seem to always exceed preseason expectations, but not to any great degree. I think Frank Haith would be on the hot seat there if Tulsa's athletic department wasn't having major financial issues, to where they basically had a $300,000 give back retention bonus last year, took a pay cut with his 2-year extension. To me, there's just doesn't seem to be a lot of institutional faith or investment in that program. And given what they lost from a team that wasn't very good to begin with, I just am not feeling too excited about Tulsa. I think that they're going to slip back to the bottom 3 or 4 in this league. And I think Haith would be on his way out, if not for that athletic department's financial issues, you know, that are really going to hamstring them both firing a coach and then hiring someone that's going to be perceived as an upgrade to Haith.
I got nothing else.
There's not a lot there.
There's just not a lot to actually discuss with that program. So let's keep it moving. I do want to talk about UCF, because while I think that everyone knows at this, like, I feel like the secret's out on USF. And I think that Wichita State might actually be the sneakiest, really good team in the conference this year. But I think that UCF is kind of right there. Now, they lose the big 3 from the team that came, like, so close to knocking off Duke last year. They lose BJ Taylor. They lose Aubrey Dawkins. They lose Taco Fall. And that is a lot to replace. But the thing about the group that they have right now is they have, like, some sneaky dudes coming in that are transfers that no one is really talking about, right? Like Dazon Ingram, who spent 4 seasons playing for Alabama in 2017. He averaged 10 points a game. He's a grad transfer there. They have Matt Milon, who was a shooter that averaged 13 points a game at William & Mary the last 2 seasons. Uat Alok, who was the top junior college player in college basketball heading into the class of 2018, he left TCU after 1 semester, and he will be eligible in January. They have a kid from South Carolina coming in. There are a couple JUCO transfers that are supposed to be pretty good coming in. They have a ton of size. They have this kid named Colin Smith who transferred from GW, was a really intriguing prospect at GW. I saw him a lot when he was there as a freshman. He ended up leaving, and he didn't have a great redshirt sophomore season with UCF, but he looked really, really good at times and was really, really good in the tournament. And now with a bigger role, I kind of think, like, he's one of the breakout players in this league. I have questions about what's going to happen at the point. Like, I don't know if they actually have a point guard that you're going to be able to trust for 40 minutes playing in a competitive league. But I do think that they have enough size, they have enough talent that they are a little bit better than maybe they're going to get credit for. I don't really necessarily have like a bold prediction because I think that they are probably an NIT team. But I do think that this is going to be a team that like pushes to finish in the top half. Like, I just think that they're better than people are going to give them credit for.
I agree. And I think that Johnny Dawkins there has that thing that it's going to be sustainable. And I think he's a better coach than we probably think, or that he gets credit for, because I think we're learning that that Stanford job is a little bit more difficult in the post Mike Montgomery era than we probably would have guessed. And so I like the way that they're situated, you know, for the future, if not necessarily an NCAA tournament team this year.
Yeah. And look, I wrote something about this, and I wrote something about Trey Jones and how UCF decided to guard him. But I don't think that you can be a horrible coach and come up with a game plan where you have Taco Fall guarding Trey Jones, so you can use Taco Fall, the 7'6" center, as essentially like Zion protection at the rim. I don't think that you can make the tweaks that he made to what he does against Duke last year in the tournament and not be a good coach. You know, I don't know if he's Chris Beard, and I don't know if he's Brad Stevens, and I don't know if he's kind of somebody that's necessarily at that level, but I do think that he is better than the jokes that we were making when he was at Stanford, if that makes sense. And I really respect what he did against Trey Jones in the NCAA tournament last year. I thought that was absolutely brilliant. And I thought it took some balls to make that change and make that adjustment.
I agree.
All right, let's move on. Last team we got is Wichita State. Talk to me about them, Travis.
Last year, obviously a rebuilding year for Greg Marshall and the AAC, but they really figured things out really towards the end of January, and then won 9 of their last 11 games to make the NIT semifinals. It's difficult to say if this is a reboot or reload type year for Wichita State, because they did lose Marcus McDuffie and Samaje Haynes-Jones off that team, two stalwarts for that program. And then the guy maybe that was supposed to take the reins, at least offensively, Teddy Allen, got kicked off the team this summer, the former West Virginia transfer, no longer part of the program, which leaves them really, really young. One of the seniors that they do have, though, is Jaime Echenique, who might be the best non-James Wiseman big man in the conference, averaged 9.6 boards and one block a game, shot 54% from the field. And then they've got some interesting pieces back. Dexter Dennis, Eric Stevenson, Jamarius Burton, Trey Wade is a junior college transfer. They've got a lot of interesting pieces where I think if you look at Greg Marshall's best teams, they don't have that upper echelon NBA-type talent that they had when they were in the Valley. But I think they've got enough that they're going to be interesting. You know, maybe in that top 6, top 5 area, which to me is probably not good enough to make the NCAA tournament. I wanted my bold take to be that this was going to be Greg Marshall's last year at Wichita State, because I think that they're finding maybe a little bit of a ceiling they're bumping up to since moving over from the Valley. But, you know, Rob, we talked before we started recording. I don't know. I don't think Greg Marshall is the commodity that he was 3, 4, 5 years ago. And with his salary above $3 million, I just don't know where he goes. Unless Wichita State kind of recaptures the magic from earlier in the decade. So that's not going to be my bold take, because I just don't know what the options for him are going to be if he was even looking to leave at the end of this year. So my bold take is that there's just not going to be enough offense for Wichita State to get back to the NCAA tournament, and they're relegated to trying to make Madison Square Garden for the second straight year in the NIT.
I think that this is closer to a tournament team than you're giving them credit for. And I think that there's a chance that they end up being kind of like in that top 3 range in the AAC. I think that you mentioned Dennis and Stevenson coming back. Like, I think that they are really, really good guards. I think that they have some really good big guys. I think that there is there was enough youth on their roster last year that they are going to continue the growth that we saw during the season. Like you mentioned, I think it was – overall, they won 9 of their last 11 in league play, and then won 14 of their last 18 overall, including correct, like a run where they won at Furman, won at Clemson, and won at Indiana on the road in the NIT. Like, they have some guys that that went through some really tough situations at the end of their first year, kind of in college basketball. So I think that there's room for growth still, even with what they are losing. And, you know, I think it's actually with Greg Marshall, it's a really interesting conversation to have, because how much of the success that he had during that like 5-year run of Wichita State's dominance was due to the fact that like he had legitimately 4 NBA players in Klee Anthony early, Fred VanVleet, Ron Baker, and Landry Shamet. How much of it was because he got that talent into the program and maybe he's not getting that same level of talent there, versus the fact that he was able to have those guys playing in the Valley instead of playing in the American, you know, if that makes sense. So I do think it's an interesting conversation to have. I buy into the idea that he finds a way to like get it done with whoever he has on the roster, because we were talking about how they might not be like a top 10 team in the American last season when we did this podcast, and they kind of proved us wrong with that. So I buy into the idea that he can still really, really coach. And, you know, we talked about kind of like some of this stuff with the name, image, and likeness, the benefits. I think Wichita State is the program that should be like rallying for this and pushing for this and wanting it more than anything else, because, you know, when you are supported by the Cook brothers, then you have more money than God in college sports. And in the city of Wichita, nothing matters more than the Shockers, you know? So I think that we are, you know, if you are Wichita State and you're a booster and you're Greg Marshall, like the way to get this program back to being like, I don't want to say back to being great again, but back to being like a consistent top 10 to top 15 team, is to be able to give yourself a situation where you can compete with some of the highest programs or some of the biggest programs in the country. And the way to do that is to just be able to pay the kids that you, what you want to pay them, you know? So I do think that this is a program that would benefit a lot from having that kind of name, image, and likeness available to them. Like if you, let's say you're a top 50 recruit, right? And your decision is to go play for like Ole Miss or go play for Wichita State. Ole Miss, you're going to be like the second fiddle to a really, really bad football program. Or you can go to Wichita State where you're a god in the city of Wichita, and you're going to have like, Charles Koch or whatever his name is, willing to sponsor you or endorse you for whatever they want to sponsor or endorse. So I mean, I know that's a different conversation for a different podcast, but I just can't stop thinking about how schools like Wichita State and schools like Creighton and schools like VCU and Richmond and Memphis and places like that can really, really benefit from things like this.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be – if assuming that that happens, I think it'll be interesting to see what the shoe companies do, because if the shoe companies sit it out because they don't want to be essentially picking favorites or more than they already allegedly do, then I think it does open the door for these, for lack of a better term, second-tier type programs to really hammer home if they have the booster base to maybe upgrade their recruiting. Because there's more room to grow there than maybe some other programs.
Well, listen, Travis, we've been at this for an hour. I don't really have anything else to add. Are you good to go?
I think so.
All right. Well, listen, guys, you can follow Travis on Twitter at TravisHines21. You can find me at Rob Doster. If you enjoyed this content, please rate, review, subscribe, share, do all the things that make us happy as podcasters. And we will catch you guys again next week with the Big 12 Preview Podcast.